The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
We are spiritual beings having a human experience. Welcome to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Better, get healthy, and help animals. Welcome to Main Street Vegan with your host, Victoria Moran.
If you overhear a conversation among vegan women, it might sound something like, wasn't it cool what Joaquin Phoenix said on the SAG Awards? And then that he left for a pig vigil. I love that. And I can hardly wait till Starbucks rolls out that whole line of vegan food all across the country. Oh, yeah, I'm still looking for a gynecologist who has a clue about the way I eat. Well, today on the Main Street Vegan program, you will meet two incredible OBGYNs who are both ethical vegans and whole food plant-based experts, too. This is gonna be good. Hi, everybody. I'm Victoria Moran, your host for the Main Street Vegan program. If you are new, please check out everything I'm up to at mainstreetvegan.net. You can subscribe there to our newsletter and our blog. There's also a Main Street Vegan listeners group on Facebook that we'd love to have you as part of. And if you're somebody who regularly enjoys this show, it would mean a lot if you would let people know at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you like to listen, because 5-star ratings and positive reviews mean a whole lot. Thank you very, very much. And we are doing something different today. Rather than having one guest per segment, we're going to have a three-way conversation so that these two professional colleagues on different continents can bounce ideas off one another, and you'll get the best possible information and the most of it. So I have two wonderful, amazing female medical doctors, experts on women's health and plant-based living, scheduled for today. And I'm going to start on the West Coast of the United States, introducing Dr. Deborah Shapiro. Deborah Shapiro, MD, is a board-certified OBGYN who's practiced more than 26 years. She is also a certified health coach, a graduate of Main Street Vegan Academy, and the T. Colin Campbell Program in Plant-Based Nutrition. She has hundreds of hours of continuing medical education, and her coaching practice attracts people who are interested in making a permanent switch to a whole food plant-based diet, reversing chronic disease, and getting off unnecessary medications. Welcome, Deborah.
Hello. Thank you so much, Victoria. This is such an honor to be on your show. I've really enjoyed listening to all of them so far. Thank you so much for having me.
It's an honor to have you. And obviously, I know you because yes, you did spend a week in my living room at
Main Street
Academy. You're one of four medical doctors who've taken the program. So I'm so proud of all of you. So I believe we're still connecting with Neetu. Let me see.
Hello. Neetu, are you with us yet?
You are here. Fabulous. So let me go ahead and introduce you. And then we can be three women talking health. Dr. Neetu Bajikal is a consultant OBGYN in London with 35 years experience in women's health, and she is one of the first U.S. board-certified lifestyle medicine physicians in the U.K. She's a passionate vegan and has personally benefited, as have her patients, from following a whole food plant-based diet. She runs a voluntary service, Women for Women's Health, set up to empower women to make better and more informed health choices. So welcome, Doctors Bajikal and Shapiro. Wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
Hi, Neetu. Hello. Hi, Deborah.
So when we were doing a little bit of pre-planning, the two of you said that you wanted to do your own kind of vegan story intros, one coming more from the plant-based side, one more from the vegan side. So if you know who wants to be first, please start.
Deborah, you want to go? Sure. Thank you very much. Well, this is always an evolution, right? I started out eating very poorly. And I was raised on a lot of processed food, a lot of high-fat food, and my mother really suffered from diabetes and then a brain tumor and died when I was still quite young. So when I got to be about the age that she was when she got sick, when I got to be into my 50s, I started thinking more about what I was eating. And I don't remember exactly what inspired me initially. I was starting to get off of meat and eating more fish. And then I saw a patient who had a miscarriage and she had mercury poisoning. And I checked my own mercury level and it was quite high. And that really started me thinking that what we ate had consequences to our health, even more than just thinking about the animals and thinking about and about the environment. But really, I started wondering more about what I was eating and putting into my own body after I got sick from mercury, from fish. And it was actually a patient of mine who first told me about Farm Sanctuary. And I visited and I was quite moved by the plight of farm animals. And I really developed a bigger worldview of compassion and enlarging my circle of compassion to all animals. And then that same patient told me about Michael Greger's work and nutritionfacts.org. And so everything just sort of coalesced or came together into this whole of understanding of the plant-based nutrition, both from a human health standpoint, the environmental health standpoint, and also the animals. And I made the transition myself and then decided it was very difficult in the small amount of time that I had with my patients in private practice to make a very big difference in their lives. Well, I tried very often, but and especially when I worked at Kaiser, it was very difficult. It was such a short period of time. So I became a health coach. And I first, coming to your program was just a fantastic experience and listening to you always. And then I learned more about coaching and now I have a coaching program.
So. Cool. Love that story. And you are out of the San Francisco Bay Area. So yes. Neetu, you're up next.
Yes. I actually was born a vegetarian. I was a vegetarian most of my life. Occasionally, out of curiosity, tried some chicken when I grew up in India in my friend's house, much to my mother's dismay because she was an ethical vegetarian. And I didn't really think about it at that stage. Was vegetarian because that's how my parents were, not for religious reasons, but for ethical reasons. And I then moved to the UK and saw a couple of programs when I was pregnant with my second daughter and became completely vegetarian overnight. Still hadn't made the link between dairy and, animal suffering because I was vegetarian because of animals. And until my daughter came home and my younger daughter, she was about 9. And she said, "Mommy, you're going to feed me my dog next." And I said, "No, I'm not." She said, "You just gave me sausages." And so I was vegetarian myself, but I was giving my children, on occasions, fish fingers and sausages. I never cooked it myself, but I used to let them have it. So anyway, she got me thinking. And at the same time, it was quite interesting. I was going through a very early menopause at the age of 38, what is known as premature ovarian failure. I didn't know it. Doctors tend to be terrible. We never acknowledge any of our health problems. So I thought I was stressed. And I then soon realized that actually I was going through an early menopause. Nobody in my family had ever been through something like that. So I wasn't really prepared for all the symptoms of menopause at that age. I was a busy, doctor with young children. Anyway, to cut a long story short, she turned vegan. I thought I need to support her. So I became vegan too. I immediately got what she was trying to say. But very interestingly, within 3 months of changing how I was eating, I noticed huge changes in how I was feeling. I was just about to go on hormone replacement, and becoming vegan meant that I wasn't going to necessarily go down that route, even though I would prescribe it for my patients. But just changing the way I ate really made a huge difference. I still struggle, though, of making that connection with food and medicine and health, because we were never taught that in medical school, you see? And it took me several years to put two and two together. And it was only about 10, 15 years ago that I started realizing the power of food and started bringing it into my patient practice, because as a surgeon, I was making people better, but I didn't prevent problems. I was sorting them out after they had the problems, you see? So I realized that food and lifestyle medicine was such a powerful tool, because most of what we see are lifestyle diseases. And I got quite upset and angry because I felt I should have been taught this in medical school. And so now I've made it my mission to, you know, talk to medical students and to my trainees and to anybody who's actually willing to listen. And so thank you, Victoria, for inviting me.
I love these stories. You know, it doesn't matter where we start out, we end up at the same place, and it's so great to be here. So as I'm sure you're both aware, women want gynecologists in particular, of all their healthcare providers, who really understand them, who really listen to them. And so we really need to get more plant-based and vegan doctors in this specialty. So why did you choose this one, either one of you?
Why did I choose?
Gynecology.
Oh, this is definitely the best specialty. You know, in America, I don't know if you have this same recommendations, and we've talked briefly, Neetu, about this, but in America, we have this annual exam that I think for a lot of women, it's almost a sacred time, right? You go for your annual exam and you spend this time with your OBGYN. And I've developed, you know, in 24 years of when I was in private practice, of seeing the same patients over and over again and really getting to be part of their lives. And I delivered their babies. Sometimes I delivered their grandchildren. So I was there when they had miscarriages. I was there when they need surgeries. I was there, you know, to manage birth control. So, and difficulties with spouses and marriages and divorces. So it is the best specialty, because you do primary care for women, and you can do surgery and save lives. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I rushed in to do, you know, a surgery that would be life-saving, and which was exhilarating and wonderful, frightening too, but wonderful. And then also you get to deliver babies, and there's nothing, really nothing, that compares to being in that room when you're bringing a new life into the world. It just isn't. There's incredible high. So it is the most wonderful and satisfying specialty that I can imagine, for those three reasons.
Wow. So Dr. Bejikal, while we're talking about babies, talk to us a little bit about diet and how that relates to fertility, pregnancy, breastfeeding.
Yes. Actually, you know, people often think that women's health is something different. You know, we get the same diseases that men get. Heart disease is actually more common in women than men. But also, women's health starts, you know, right from the time you're inside your mother's womb. So really, at every stage of our lives, we are particularly susceptible to problems. And so when you have somebody who's pregnant, they're in a very vulnerable situation. They want to know the best for themselves and for their baby. And if the health provider is not aware that actually there is a lot of advice that can be given, which is very, very sensible, simple things about exercise, about food, because there's so much of confusion out there. And we do know that whether you're pregnant, whether you're wanting to be pregnant, whether you're having fertility issues, whether you're menopausal, whether you're a man, the closer you move to eating plants, the closer you move to eating a whole food plant-based diet, then the more optimal your pregnancy outcome will be, the more optimal your overall health will be. You know, nobody has to be 100% plants only, but obviously, because we don't have the studies for that in huge numbers, but what we do know is that vegans tend to have lower incidence of blood pressure problems in pregnancy, lower incidence of diabetes. They tend to do better with regards to things like endometriosis, which can affect fertility. So really, at every stage of life, whether you have a small daughter or a baby, there is nothing like adopting the right sort of nutrition, exercise, stress levels. All these things play a huge role. So at every stage, women can benefit from doing the right thing and getting the right advice from health professionals. And often they don't.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because the one time that I know that adults really get flack about being vegan, yes, is when they're pregnant or looking to become pregnant. Knowing everything that you just said, how can that possibly be?
So the problem is there's a lot of confusion that is often misrepresented in the media. Doctors are not taught nutrition. So when we are not taught nutrition, we are reliant on the same sources that our patients are. So they read magazines or newspapers that may not have the whole truth. They don't, everybody will agree that fruits and vegetables are fine. But what they forget is there are large swaths of countries that actually have women who are pregnant and are vegetarian or often plant-based mostly. And they have absolutely no problems with fertility, with body weight issues, or with pregnancies. However, because the information is not out there, there is confusion. And when there's confusion, then all kinds of diets come in, all kinds of advice comes in. And as a result, the truth often gets buried. That's what I have found amongst my colleagues, amongst professionals. It's just there is confusion. That's what there is.
And obviously among lay people as well. So does either of you know anything about sexual pleasure in women? I mean, we've seen the preliminary studies. I know they're working on a big study to look at erectile dysfunction and a dietary component in, yes, in men. Are women happier in bed if they're plant-based?
I don't know if there are any studies about this. Do you know, Nitu? But in general, you know, your energy level is going to be better. The blood supply to your genital organs is going to be improved just as it is with men. And you're going to have increased serotonin and dopamine and just feel happier as well when you have healthier gut bacteria that are creating these neurotransmitters. So between all of that, I would think that it would make sexual pleasure that much better. But what do you think, Nitu?
I would agree. I'm not aware of any studies, and I will certainly go away and look at this because this is interesting. But what I do know is that there are a lot of female health conditions that really stop us from enjoying sex, one of them being endometriosis. Endometriosis is a condition where the lining of the womb or the endometrium grows outside and can cause quite a lot of discomfort and pain, making people not want to have sex because it's painful. And that, of course, has other repercussions like fertility. But just having the, you know, sex as often as somebody who doesn't have this condition can be a big factor. So endometriosis, which we know responds very well to a whole food plant-based way of eating, even a condition called polycystic ovarian syndrome, it's often associated with anxiety and depression and difficulty with sleep problems, menopause, all these things where improve on a plant-based diet. So when they do, the natural corollary would be that you would expect that sexual pleasure and intercourse, when it becomes not so painful and uncomfortable, is more pleasurable. But I don't know of any randomized trials or studies. I don't know if they can be done, actually. But yes, I certainly don't know officially of any.
Okay. So let's just move on to menopause. You did talk about that, Nitu, that experiencing the early menopause. But for people coming to that time of life at the regular age or another 51. Age, yeah. Any studies, any stories, anything that we should know about that?
Yes, I mean, definitely with menopause. The menopause is an official term when you've stopped having periods for a whole year. That's when somebody is going through the menopause, and a year afterwards, when you've not had any more periods for no other reason, you're not pregnant, you don't have stress, anxiety, any of that, you've actually stopped your periods because your ovaries have stopped functioning, that is known as menopause. And postmenopause is after that. The average age all over the world is about 51. But actually, menopausal symptoms or perimenopause, these start, you know, as much as 8 years before. So women in their 40s may be experiencing hormonal fluctuations and hot flushes and difficulty with sleep and mood changes and skin dryness and vaginal dryness, but actually their hormone levels may not show that. And so there are studies to show that women in Japan, for example, have only 20% incidence of hot flushes compared to 75 to 80% of women in the US. Only 10% of Chinese women historically have hot flushes. Now, it may be that they don't come up and tell us and they're shy to talk about it, but actually that's not what all our studies show. Our studies show that 8 out of 10 women in the UK, and I'm sure it's the same in the US, they feel shy and they don't talk about their symptoms. Only, you know, a couple of women, 2 out of 10 women will actually come up and say, "Doctor, I'm suffering, I can't sleep, I'm having hot flushes, my relationship is breaking down." So even in these countries, we are actually struggling to talk about it. But what we do know is that the Southeast Asian countries, we think because of their soy intake, their isoflavone intake, the miso, the natto, the seaweed, their lifestyles, all these tend to really actually not have that crash of estrogen that causes the hot flushes, which we see in the Western world.
Well, you know that we did have a request from a listener that I ask you about someone who went through menopause 10 years ago, but now seems to be having a lot of the menopausal symptoms all over again, hot flashes, weight gain, and an inability to lose that weight, even with a whole food plant-based diet and an active lifestyle. Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
So she hasn't resumed bleeding, right?
No.
She's gone the whole 10 years without bleeding and symptoms coming back. Well, I certainly want to make sure that other hormone levels were normal, like her thyroid was still functioning normally.
Yes, I think that one does need to look for other reasons. Did she, you know, how old she is, what actually happened 10 years before? Was it a traumatic incident? Was there stress? Was there another medical condition completely? Because really, to have stopped periods 10 years ago and then to have a recurrence of symptoms now, is she on some particular medications that can actually give you hot flushes or make you put on weight? So she definitely needs a very detailed medical workup, because, you know, help is available. It just needs to be, you know, just because somebody's on a whole food plant-based diet doesn't mean they can't have any symptoms. They may. And so, you know, that's what the beauty about lifestyle medicine is. It's not isolated from Western medicine. You know, it works hand in hand. It just means that with plant-based diets and things, the woman or the man is actually in the driving position. They can make the changes themselves. But there will be situations where they need to, you know, see a doctor and have treatment, sometimes surgery, sometimes medication. So this lady certainly needs a very thorough discussion so that she can be guided and help provided, actually.
There are also even supplements, you know, like niacin supplements that can cause hot flashes. So I don't know whether she started taking some different supplements as well.
This is why we need more lifestyle medicine doctors. So we've just got 2 minutes left in this segment, but I do want to switch to an earlier time of life. The puberty and that, particularly for young girls. And you mentioned Neetu soy and good things about soy. And yet out in the world, you hear soy makes children mature more quickly. Soy makes men have breasts. Okay, let's start on that. And after the break, we'll finish it. Anybody take it who's excited about this?
very excited about it, but Deborah, you can go.
Okay.
And I can follow on afterwards.
It turns out that in the breast, as an example, because people are always worried about soy and breast health. I know we were starting to talk about the menarche, but let's just start with breast health, that there are actually two receptors for estrogen in the breast. There's an alpha receptor and a beta receptor. And it turns out that soy actually fits in the beta receptor, which actually down-regulates growth, whereas dairy estrogens and our own estrogens, so mammalian estrogen, sits in the alpha receptor. So it's very different. These two receptors, one promotes growth and the other sort of downregulates it. So that's one way that soy is actually protective against breast cancer. It acts like a selective estrogen receptor modulator, a SERM, like tamoxifen, something you would take even if you had breast cancer. It also works, we're still talking about breast cancer, just if we could, it also works as a to help with DNA repair, to upregulate the genes that work for DNA repair. So, for example, when people have...
We lost you, Deborah.
Oh.
Well, we're coming up to break, so...
It's very exciting, Victoria. I mean, soy is a really exciting and a topic that has had about 40,000 studies, and there's a lot that... of myths that need to be dispelled. And so certainly we should do that after the break. It is really, really important.
As soon as we come back, we will blast those myths. Thanks everybody for being part of the Main Street Vegan program. Stay with us through these breaks and we'll be back with more.
Experience the difference. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
Welcome back to Main Street Vegan with your host, Victoria Moran.
Hello, vegans and pre-vegans and veg-curious people and Unity folks and Unity Online Radio listeners. Welcome to each and every one of you who has found your way to this program. As I believe you're aware, our program is presented by Unity Online Radio, which is located at Unity Village. That's just outside Kansas City, Missouri. It's the extraordinarily beautiful headquarters of the Unity Movement, which is a very open-minded and eclectic religious organization founded in 1892 by a couple of deeply committed vegetarians. So it is fitting that the very first vegan spirituality forum and retreat will take place at Unity Village, Missouri, September 10 through 13, 2020. So if you are someone who identifies as religious or spiritual of any tradition, please check out the event at thespiritualforum.org. They are co-sponsoring the retreat with In Defense of Animals. Dr. Will Tuttle, Dr. Lisa Kemmerer, Dr. Milton Mills, and myself will all be there to present. And there will also be a lot of time devoted to input from participants and how we can carry this life-promoting message of vegan living to people in our spiritual communities. So that is thespiritualforum.org. Costs for registration and accommodations is being kept really low, and early bird registration is available until January 31. So if you can commit quickly, you will save some money. Now, let us get back to our brilliant and fascinating guests, Deborah Shapiro, MD, and Neetu Bejakal, MD. And we were talking about soy and maturation in young women and cancer. And Deborah, finish up. Neetu, carry on.
Thank you. You know, I skipped over the maturation because it is interesting. I've heard people say, that aren't children now developing so much earlier, and they're getting, seeing kids are getting, you know, they're having their periods at age 8. And I did just some research about this, and what I found, and Nitya, you can see if you agree or disagree, but it seems like there's been more of a disconnect between when girls are getting their first breast buds, like pubarchy, and when they actually get their period. So the change in when they're actually in menarche, when they're actually getting their first period, isn't that huge. It's not like we've gone from, you know, 13 down to 8, but maybe, you know, maybe 12 to 11 in African Americans, actually, it's a greater difference. They're getting them a little bit earlier. But the real difference is that we are seeing much younger girls developing breast buds. So there's this more of a disconnect between the age of pubarchy and the age of menarche. And that's what I had read. Is that what you had read as well?
I would agree with that, definitely. And what I would say is that people often think that soya is this magic bean. It is a magic bean in many ways, but what it contains is not unique to the soybean. You know, it has isoflavones, but it's not only isoflavones. They're basically, isoflavones are plant estrogens, phytoestrogens that have weak actions like estrogens, but also has blocking actions. And that's the beauty about chickpeas and red clover and many of the lentils, and soybean has a little bit more of that. And as Deborah was saying, it does work more on the beta receptor of estrogen. So when young children actually eat soy, we know both boys and girls, they actually reduce their risk of getting breast cancer or prostate cancer for the future because of the way it works on the breasts and on the bones and on various other tissues, that actually it is a protective effect rather than a harmful effect. Nobody will come to any harm, including women who have breast cancer. So if you want to reduce your risk of breast cancer, one should be having a couple of portions of minimally processed soya in a day. And if you are unfortunate enough to get a diagnosis of breast cancer, we know that there's a 30% reduction of dying from breast cancer if you have soya as part of a varied plant-based diet. So it is really important to understand that the phytoestrogens or the plant estrogens don't behave like the mammalian estrogen that is available from our body fat, which produces most of our estrogen, or from estrogen that comes through animal sources. So menarche may become slightly earlier because of better nutrition and things like that. But certainly soya is protective in children. And even if you have a thyroid condition, soya doesn't need to be limited to anything. You still should be eating the two portions. It's not going to have an effect. You just need to have your thyroid checked like everybody else who has a problem every 6 months or so. So I just want people to understand that one does not need to be scared of soya. If you don't like it or you're allergic to it, that's a different matter. But otherwise, there should be no reason to cut it out of your diet. In fact, there's every reason to bring it into your diet, whether you have a small son or a daughter, or for you yourself, or for your mother, or for your father. Everybody can have it. It reduces risk and it promotes health.
Right. Yes. And it's just sad that doctors are still seem to be promoting this idea that soy is somehow dangerous. I can't tell you how many times, and you probably, I don't know if it's the same thing in
yes,
across the pond.
Don't
but
have soya.
Don't, especially if they have breast cancer. But I just wanted to say that I think women were probably aware of the selective estrogen receptor modulators or things like tamoxifen that people take when they have breast cancer. And actually, so the soy phytoestrogens act like that. Not only by sitting in the beta receptor, but they also increase the genes that promote DNA repair and prevent recurrence that way, and also help if you do have the BRCA mutation. And they also work as an aromatase inhibitor. And this is, people probably also may be familiar with drugs like Arimidex that people take when they have breast cancer, that actually helps to lower the circulating estrogens by inhibiting this hormone, this enzyme that takes androgens to estrogens. So it's another way that you're actually going to reduce the risk of a recurrence and reduce the risk of breast cancer if you have more soy. Two, I agree with her, with Dr. With Nitya, absolutely, that two whole soy products a day would be excellent. And the earlier, the better.
Yes.
For children.
And the important thing to understand, people are often confused about what a portion is. A portion is what fits into your hand, and that's really small. We're talking about a small handful, 80 grams. So if you have a child, their hand is very small, so it'll be even less than that. So an apple is a portion for an adult, and a couple of slices of apple is a portion for a child. So it's just based on that. The other important thing is 80 to 90% of the soya that is produced in this world is actually produced, which is genetically modified and is produced for feeding, for animal agriculture, while only about 6% of the soya that is produced is for human consumption. So all the rainforests that are being burned down is actually not for human consumption of soy. Instead, it is for feeding, the animals that we then consume. So it's important to understand that it's also used for fuel, but really it's only 6% and it's not the genetically modified. So if you're going to have soy, try and opt for the organic version, the unsweetened version of soy milk, and edamame beans, miso, natto, tofu, tempeh. These are all great sources that, you know, people can enjoy and learn different things. But if you don't like it, that's a different matter.
Well, tempeh for dinner for me. So thank you both on that. So Deborah, I know that a particular interest of yours is epigenetics. So if you could give us an elementary definition of what that is, and also tell us a little bit about what happened during that Canadian ice storm.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you. Yes, this is something very, very new. We were not taught about it in medical school. I graduated medical school in 1989. And really, the idea of epigenetics and really only came to be understood and still being understood and being studied was in the 90s, so the end of the last century. But the idea of epigenetics actually means on top of the genome. And if you remember from when you were studying genetics in high school, that every one of your nucleated cells has the same DNA, the same chromosomes, the 46 chromosomes, and they encode, but with these base pairs, really everything that happens in your body, everything that you are, you know, your blood type, your eye color, all of that. And you get one chromosome from one parent and one from the other, and there you are, the full complement. But it turns out that even though every cell has the same genetic material, the same base pairs, what actually gets expressed in those cells is very tightly controlled. And here's an example. You know, your salivary glands make saliva, right? They know how to make saliva. But in your stomach, those cells are making hydrochloric acid. Very, very different. Now, both cells have all the genetic material to be able to make both those things. But can you imagine if they got confused? What if you were making hydrochloric acid in your mouth? You know, you would not be very popular as a lover, right? So this is important to understand about gene expression. And what we now know is that your diet and your lifestyle and your stress and your exercise, all of this affects the expression of your genes. And actually, one of the earlier experiments on humans acknowledgments of this was with Dean Ornish when he was reversing early stage prostate cancer. Yeah. Because he took 98 men, I think, he divided them into, with early stage prostate cancer, divided them into two groups. One group had a low fat plant-based diet, 11% fat. They did exercise 30 minutes, 6 days a week of walking. They had stress reduction, yoga or meditation, and this plant-based diet. And after a year, all the men that were in the study group had a reduction in their PSA, the prostate specific antigen. And the men who were just doing what their doctors told them to do, actually a number of them, actually, I think six of them needed surgery, needed procedures. But more than that, what was really extraordinary was what he found after just 3 months, not even the year, but after 3 months, he found that over 500 genes changed expression. He had over 450 genes that promote cancer were downregulated, things like the RAS oncogene and things that I had even heard about in medical school, and over 40 genes that protect against cancer, the tumor suppressor genes, the natural killer cell genes, were upregulated. So this was extraordinary, and that was just after 3 months. But you were asking about Project Ice Storm, and I welcome people to look this up. It was amazing. So in 1998, there was a huge ice storm in Quebec. And I think there was, you know, no power for 40 days, tremendous stress. People were exposed to tremendous cold. And so tremendous social upheaval and stress. And researchers decided to study the offspring of women who were pregnant during that time. And they were able to divide them up into different levels of stress, both perceived stress and actual stress. And what they found was that there were, well, first, hundreds of genes also changed expression. These were genes that coded for things like immunoglobulins and genes for glucocorticoids. So you could see that the offspring of children who experienced more stress were going to be dealing with stress differently and dealing with even having a different immune system their whole lives. And there was also more autism in women who experienced more stress, in the offspring of women who experienced more stress, more autoimmune disease, and more metabolic disease. And this is just, when you think about it, when you think about how important it is, the milieu that the baby is developing in, not only for this child, but, you know, the germ cells are developing inside the child that's developing inside the uterus. So we're really affecting future generations as well. You know, what happened to my mother when she was inside my grandmother had an effect on who I am. And that's epigenetics. Absolutely.
Yes.
Beautiful. Wow, that's exciting. Anything to add, Neetu?
No, this has been also shown, you know, after the war, when they found that starvation then resulted in the way epigenetics worked, the grand or the offspring, the grandchildren, had a higher chance of being overweight and obese. So epigenetics is fascinating, and we shouldn't underestimate it at all for effects, you know, that can be seen into the far future. So how you eat today will have a big effect on what happens for the future generations. So it is fascinating. Deborah was absolutely, that story of the Canadian ice storm is really quite an eye-opener.
Yes.
So it just makes us feel like we have more power, you know, more say over our own lives and even our children. So I promised that we were going to do a kind of Ask the OBGYN quiz show. This is going to throw out some of these conditions that women deal with or worry about. And either of you, both of you, just fairly quick answers and maybe some guidance for somebody who's dealing with this. How about something I hear about every day, including ads in the New York City subways, fibroids?
Yes. Mm. So fibroids are particularly common in women of color, and we don't know what the background is. But what we do know is whatever your color, you can actually reduce the size of fibroids or increase the size of fibroids with what you eat and what you drink. So we know women who drink alcohol, especially if they drink beer, they have increase in the size of fibroids. Women who drink green tea seem to reduce their size of fibroids. Women who eat red meat seem to increase their size of fibroids. Fibroids are lumps of muscle, benign growths. So, you know, the more fruits and vegetables you eat, you tend to have a reduction in size. So essentially, coming back again, what you eat, you are what you eat. And fibroids can actually be influenced by this, just like periods can, and endometriosis can, and polycystic ovarian syndrome, and menopause.
Well, and they're fed by estrogen, right? So
yes,
getting rid of dairy.
They're estrogen dependent tumors. So basically, just like breast cancer, fibroids, adenomyosis, endometriosis, these are all estrogen fueled conditions. That's why weight loss helps with all these situations, where you can actually have an improvement in your symptoms as well as in the actual condition itself.
How about a bone health, osteopenia and osteoporosis?
Well, it's interesting because studies have shown that in countries where they have the most dairy, they actually suffer from the...
We lost you again, Deborah.
So what
do you want to say? There you are.
Hello?
We missed about 10 seconds. Please back up just a bit, Deborah.
Yes. There was a huge study out of Sweden that was looking at over 100,000 women. And when women had more than 3 milk products a day, they had not only more fractures, but more death from all cause than when women compared to women who had less than 1 milk product a day. And I know they used to say that actually animal protein would leach calcium from your bones. I remember hearing that a lot and maybe even saying that, but that may not be entirely true. We may not know exactly why, but we know that animal protein is not good for bone health. It doesn't exactly leach calcium from the bones, but it's not good for bone health. It's certainly not good for kidney health as well, and that may be one reason. But much more important, if you want to keep your bones strong, is to exercise them. My father actually used to say, when he saw me lying on the couch watching TV after school, get off the couch and start, you know, if you don't use your legs, they're going to fall off. And I think in some ways, it's sort of true. And I know Dr. Clapper always talks about, that osteoporosis is not a disease of calcium deficiency. It just isn't. It's about exercising. So he always talks about putting on a weighted vest and going out and going for a walk. And so using your bones and your muscles is probably the best way to maintain your bones and getting adequate calcium. And there was a study of vegans. I think this came from Epic Oxford, actually. And when they saw, they actually saw that vegan women had, or vegans had less, had lower calcium levels, but if they had at least 525 milligrams of calcium. Now, you know, we recommend 1,000 milligrams of calcium a day. But when vegans, who in general are eating a less acidic diet, when vegans have at least 525 milligrams of calcium a day, they seem not to suffer from more fractures. So that is important. And calcium is a nutrient of concern for vegans.
So the important thing to remember about calcium is that it is available in most foods. It's actually drawn out from the soil. So taking calcium supplements actually can be detrimental. We know that from studies that taking a calcium supplement can actually increase your chance of having an infarction or a heart attack. So you're better off getting your calcium from sesame seeds and green leafy vegetables. Two dried figs give you all the calcium that you want. But also for bone health, one has to be very careful about, you know, the thieves that actually dissolve your bones or they steal the calcium. So salt, excessive salt in your diet, excessive sugar, excessive alcohol and coffee. These are things that are not great for your bone health. So exercise 150 minutes per week, which is roughly about half an hour, ideally an hour a day. But you want to include two times of weight resistance training in a week of, you know, exercising every muscle group for about 10, 15 minutes, not very long, but it's very important, especially if you're quite small built, then having like a vest that is actually weighted or little weights on your ends of your wrists or on your ankles will actually give you that, what Deborah was saying, exercise, but with the increased bone mass, because of the fact that even skipping and things do actually help, because that's how you build bone rather than lose bone, because we all start losing bone and muscle by after the age of 30. So you want to prevent, because falls are one of the big reasons. It's one of the three causes of women dying, you know, hip fractures, cancers, and of course, you know, heart disease and things. So it's really important that we look after our bones and our muscles. So working out is really important, and weight strengthening exercises for our muscles is especially important.
Yes.
Then let's touch on those cancers. Basically, what we think of as women's cancers, breast, ovarian, what can we do to prevent those?
Well, for breast cancer, we did talk about soy. And if you can start your children out drinking soy milk instead of getting into dairy and avoiding dairy, I think you're really going to significantly reduce this. I think it's something like a 60% reduction in later breast cancer when children, very young girls, are started on soy. So it's not something that you necessarily just want to sort of pick up when you're 50, although it's never too late. But really the most benefit you're going to see is when you start girls out young. So that would be one thing. One of the risk factors for uterine cancer is having polycystic ovarian syndrome and this anovulation where you constantly are exposing the uterus to estrogen can you still hear me?
Yes.
Okay. That's not being opposed by progesterone. So I would say anything that would reverse polycystic ovarian syndrome, like a plant-based diet, but also removing things like advanced glycation end products that are found in animal products, but also when foods, even plant-based foods, are broiled and charred and cooked at high temperature. So reducing AGEs would also reduce the risk and maybe even help reverse polycystic ovarian syndrome and reduce the risk of uterine cancer. And Neetu, do you want to talk about ovarian cancer?
Yeah. So basically what I want to say is, you know, lifestyle cancers, bowel, breast, ovarian, endometrial, they all benefit from four things. If your listeners want to remember four things to reduce cancer, lifestyle cancers, one is to try and achieve a normal body weight. We know that obesity fuels cancer like nothing else, okay? So being a normal weight, avoiding alcohol, exercising regularly, and I mean 150 minutes at least per week, and eating mostly plant-based or only plants diet will be the four things that one can do. Keeping a normal weight, avoiding alcohol and smoking and risky substances, exercising regularly, eating plants are the four things one can do to reduce ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, lung cancer, you name it, bowel cancer, breast cancer. So it's simple. Eat the right foods, move naturally, avoid risky substances, have a sense of community, reduce your stress levels, identify the stress levels, do the things that you can within your control, and what you can't, learn to let go.
I agree. Absolutely.
That's beautiful. My gosh, yes. That's so valuable. So, Deborah, you have a new coaching program, the Pregnancy Advantage. Tell us quickly about that.
Yes. Well, when I realized about the importance of epigenetics, I was thinking that it would be really wonderful if we could help produce healthier and smarter children, in addition to just helping women be healthier themselves. So the Pregnancy Advantage is really aimed for women who are thinking about getting pregnant, but in a few years, it would be great to actually catch people even 5 years before they want to have a baby, so that they can detox from chemicals that might have an influence on the health of their child. You know, they're finding glyphosate, which Neetu mentioned, because it's put on GMO soy, for example, they're finding glyphosate in the umbilical cords of babies, and that's a carcinogen. So you know, kids are coming out already exposed to toxins. So detoxing from toxins, getting to a healthy weight, and eating a plant-based diet, so that women can have healthier pregnancies and much healthier offspring, smarter offspring as well, because they find that saturated fat actually decreases the IQ of babies. So, you know, when you think about where we are right now in the world and how, you know, if we could really make the whole population healthier, happier, and smarter, just think of what might be possible.
Whoa, a lot. So how do we find out about this? Is there a website yet?
It's just started. You can look look on my website, which is anewviewoffood.com. There's also a Facebook page, The Pregnancy Advantage, and Jean Schumacher's page, which is
close enough.
It's coming up.
If you want to let us know, we can put more in the show notes at mainstreetvegan.net, where we will offer as much information about both of these amazing physicians as possible. Neetu, in our less than a minute, what should we know?
So if you want to reach out to me, I have lots of updated latest information leaflets on every possible gynecological condition you want to know about. It's called neetubajekal.com, NITUBAJEKAL.com, or you can find me on Instagram at Dr. Neetu Bajekal. But all I want to tell your listeners is thank you for listening in, and hopefully you will adopt some of the information that we have discussed and lead a very healthy, happy, and contented life.
Well, I am a healthy, happy, and contented host. You've both been wonderful, wonderful guests. This was a fabulous hour. Thanks to Unity Online Radio, and thanks to you, the listener. We'll be back next week with Dr. Neil Barnard.
That's exciting.
Join us then.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world. If you're inspired by the teachings of Dr. Wayne Dyer, you will love the Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life podcast with Nadia De La Cruz.
You are a spiritual being having a human experience. My name is Nadia De La Cruz, and I started the Change Your Thoughts, Change Your Life podcast to explore spiritual topics like manifestation and meditation with guests who share their own stories of insight, awakening, and transformation. Listen now on the mindbodyspirit.fm podcast network or wherever you get your podcasts.